This is Charlottesville Tomorrow, an advocate for our future today. Charlottesville Tomorrow is a nonpartisan community organization working on land use, transportation, and community design issues. Visit us on the web at seavilletomorrow.org.
This is Brian Wheeler, Executive Director of Charlottesville Tomorrow. Thanks for listening to this audio recording. Since 2005, Charlottesville Tomorrow has been capturing, analyzing, and sharing community news from important meetings and presentations like this one. We couldn't do it without the support of our generous donors. As someone who listens to our podcast, if you have not done so already, I hope you will join the many other community members who have made a charitable gift to support our work. Visit our website at seavilletomorrow.org and click on the donation button for more information. Thanks again for listening and for getting engaged in our community.
A leading land use expert told a packed room at the Omni Hotel Monday night that the most successful American communities are those ready for the future while retaining a sense of the past. Edward McMahon gave a talk called Community Character and Economic Vitality: What's the Connection? The event was sponsored by Charlottesville Tomorrow, and our recording begins with Michael Bills, Chairman of the Board of Directors for Charlottesville Tomorrow.
My name is Michael Bills, and as Chairman of the Board of Charlottesville Tomorrow, I'd like to welcome you here to Charlottesville Tomorrow's first ever, and maybe, given the turnout, first annual community conversation. Thank you for making the time on a cold night and a busy schedule to be here. When we founded Charlottesville Tomorrow 6 years ago, we were driven by a passion to protect this place that we call home. Your appearance here tonight is a sign that you share that passion. Charlottesville Tomorrow's approach is different. We have a firm commitment to being nonpartisan, fact-based, impartial in everything we do. We provide trustworthy information about local land use issues and tell people how and when they can be involved. Then we count on your involvement, talent, commitment, and judgment to help our community make better decisions. Many people here tonight have contributed greatly to Charlottesville Tomorrow's success. President and past board members, and most very notable in this group, and so I'd like to give a shout out to Joe Barnes, Renee Grisham, A.D. Hart, Steve McLean, Lee Middleditch, Rick Middleton, Mac Thompson, Kathy Train, and Tony Vanderwalker. And nothing in life is cheap. We are funded entirely by private donations. I see many people here who have been providing those donations since our inception, and some newcomers, and to each and every one of you, and those who were not here but have supported us, thank you very much. It's crucial. Community character and economic vitality are certainly two issues everyone cares about. And tonight's speaker, Ed McMahon, is a national leader in helping communities find and nurture the positive connections between these two issues. Ed is a senior resident fellow at the Urban Land Institute and a renowned authority on sustainable development, land conservation, and urban design. He has also worked with the Conservation Fund, where he helped improve both land conservation and land development practices through programs that balance economic and environmental goals. Ed was the co-founder of Scenic America with our very own Rick Middleton, a national nonprofit organization devoted to protecting America's scenic landscapes. After Ed's presentation, our executive director, Brian Wheeler, will introduce the panel that will join Ed to facilitate a conversation with you about how these issues pertain to Charlottesville Albemarle. Ed?
All right. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. It's great to be here. Thank you, Michael, for that kind introduction. I'm glad you kept that short. My wife is a psychotherapist, and I never forget my first time she ever heard me talk. And I was, of course, interested in what she thought I had to say. But of course, all she wanted to talk about was the introduction. And she says to me, after somebody had read my bio, she said, you know, that was ridiculous. She said, the only thing they didn't say about you is they didn't say you were a model husband now, did they? And I said, no, but good idea. Maybe I'll add that. And she says to me, go home and look it up in the dictionary. If you look up the definition of model, it's a small replica of the real thing. Anyway, thank you again for allowing me to be here. It's great to be in Charlottesville and certainly one of my favorite places to visit. I'm going to talk for about an hour. Then we're going to have a panel that's going to come up here and talk as well. I'm going to say a few words about this, the relationship between economic development, community character, and quality of life. Before I get into my talk, I'll tell you a little story about how I got interested in those three topics. 1969, I was a young second lieutenant in the United States Army. I had just finished jungle warfare training, and I was getting ready to go to Vietnam with many of my contemporaries. And literally about 1 week before I'm supposed to fly to Tonsonut Air Force Base in Saigon for reassignment to a small fire base in the Central Highlands of Vietnam, I got a call from the Pentagon, and I have a colonel on the other end of the line. He's in the personnel division, and he says to me, Lieutenant McMahon, do you have any interest in being reassigned to Germany? And I'm like, okay, Germany, let me think about that for about 2 seconds. And I said, yeah, that sounds really good. And I became very, very lucky. I was assigned as an aide to a general in the U.S. Army headquarters in Heidelberg, West Germany. And I spent 2.5 years of my life flying all over Europe in a helicopter. And that experience completely and totally changed my life. But I didn't realize quite how much it changed my life till I flew home to Birmingham, Alabama, where I grew up. And I got out of the airplane and drove home, and for the first time ever, I saw the American landscape with a completely different set of eyes. Because, ladies and gentlemen, to travel is to learn. And what I'd like to do with you tonight is to travel around this country and see what we can, and many of us have learned about what's going on in America, about this relationship between community character, economic development, and quality of life. Now, as Mike mentioned, I work for the Urban Land Institute. We are a nonprofit, non-advocacy organization founded in 1936 to try to foster best practices in land use and development. My focus is sustainable development. That's an appropriate focus because we are indeed entering a new era in America and the world. An era that will change our lives in ways no less fundamental than the Industrial Revolution. And this, of course, is the Sustainability Revolution. It's about finding better, smarter, greener, more energy-efficient ways to live and to work and to move around. People always say, well, what is sustainable development? That's, of course, the official definition that the United Nations likes to use, but I found that most people can't remember that, so I like to show them this. Who's that? That's my son. His name is Sean McMahon. He's actually 32 years old now. But I like this picture, and I've obviously used it for a very long time because it really is what sustainability is all about. It's about why you're here tonight. It's about our children. It's about our grandchildren. It's about the future, and it's about planning for the future. You know, it's also about this. It's about balance. It's about harmony. You know, Aldo Leopold said conservation was a state of harmony between man and nature, and that's really what sustainability is about as well. You know, we spend way too much time in America fighting about what we disagree about and not nearly enough time sitting down community by community to talk about what we do agree about. And that's why I think organizations like Charlottesville Tomorrow perform an incredibly important service. Because they try to get people together to talk about what they do agree about. And that's also what sustainability is about. It's about win-win solutions. Good for business, good for the community, good for the environment. And we're going to try to talk tonight about some of those things that are good for all of those things. You know, a lot of times when people think about sustainability, particularly today, they think it's all about technologies, about solar power, about renewable energies, about clean cars, about electric cars, et cetera, and all those things are part of sustainability. But if you look up the definition of sustainable in the dictionary, it will tell you that the definition of sustainable means enduring. Ladies and gentlemen, a sustainable community is a place of enduring value. It's a place of enduring value. Sustainable means lasting. So, you know, when we think about sustainability, we need to think about this as well. I love this quote from the former dean of the University of Michigan School of Architecture. If a building, a landscape, or a city is not beautiful, it will not be loved. If it's not loved, It won't be maintained and improved. In short, it won't be sustained. Sustainability is about what makes you love a community, as well as all the technology that I just talked about. You know, in ancient Athens, city leaders there, city fathers, used to take an oath of office to leave that city, that great city, not less, but more beautiful and prosperous than it was left to them. And I think that's your charge as well. How do you leave Charlottesville and Albemarle County not less, but greater, more beautiful and prosperous than it was left to you? So, you know, it's interesting, you know, spent a lot of time traveling around the United States, and I can tell you that we've done a pretty good job in America, and certainly here in Virginia, in saving some landmarks like this. And we'll talk later on about the importance and value of historic preservation. But while we've been doing a pretty good job of saving landmarks like this, we've been doing a less of a good job in saving the landscape that gives those landmarks their larger sense of meaning. And while we've been cleaning up air and water pollution, and yes, our air is cleaner, and yes, our water is cleaner in America, and while we've been cleaning up air and water pollution for the last 25 or 30 years, we've simultaneously been losing our sense of place. I mean, if I were to take you up on an airplane tomorrow morning and then just suddenly drop you around, along a road outside of most American cities, you wouldn't have the slightest idea where you were because it all looks exactly the same. I mean, where is that? Is that Albany or Allentown, Providence or Pittsburgh, Birmingham or Boise? Who can tell? Author Wallace Stegner once wrote, he said, quote, if you don't know where you are, you don't know who you are. And by that, I think he meant that all Americans, everybody in this room, has a fundamental need for a sense of orientation, for a sense of roots, for a sense of place. Sense of place. What is that? Well, it's a couple things. First, it's what makes your hometown different from my hometown. But more importantly, ladies and gentlemen, I believe sense of place is explicitly that which makes our physical surroundings worth caring about. That which makes our physical surroundings worth caring about. I can tell you that in many parts of this country and around the world, we're suffering the social, environmental, and economic consequences of building places that simply aren't worth caring about. And for all the improvements in cleaner air and cleaner water, better roads, better schools, faster computers, people still say, is this all there is? Can't our communities be more distinctive, more livable, more beautiful? Can't we have more connection with nature and the outdoors? You know, we're not building a lot right now because of the recession. But before the recession, we spent a lot of time in this state and every other place around the country fighting about development. But one of the things we've learned, I think, is that development's not really the problem. The problem is the patterns of development. But what I mean by that, a couple of things. First, where do you put it? Where do you put development? Second, how do you arrange that development? How do you arrange it? Third, what does it look like? What does development look like? Let's talk about each of these briefly. Let's talk about where you put development. It seems to me that the first principle of better development is figuring out where you should not develop. There are some places that are simply better for development than other places. I'll tell you something funny about those houses. Guess what? They're all gone now. Because building out in front of the dune line at the beach, really not the smartest thing in the world to do. Or how about building in a floodplain or on a steep slope? Or in the middle of a Civil War battlefield? You know, some places are better for development than other places. And one of the things that we found at the Urban Land Institute is if you don't have a long-range conservation plan, the same way you have a long-range transportation plan, then you're inviting opposition to development. One of the single best ways to reduce opposition to development is to have a long-range plan for the conservation of a community. In other words, what I mean by that is you figure out ahead of time where you should not develop. And then it becomes easier to facilitate and encourage development in the places that you do want it. You know, it's kind of like this. If you're driving down an interstate highway at 65 or 70 miles an hour and you hit a fog bank, what are you going to do? You're going to slam the brakes on, right? Because you cannot see where you're going. Well, that's exactly what people in America and in Virginia wanted to do with development when they couldn't see what the future looked like. They thought all land is up for grabs everywhere, so they thought they'd fight every development everywhere. So if we could actually have a plan, and you actually have a pretty good one here in Albemarle County, about what land should be preserved, then it becomes easier to facilitate and encourage development in the places that you want it. All right, now, you know, this is what I spend a lot of my time working on at ULI, green buildings. And I was pleased to see a number of LEED certified buildings in Charlottesville today and in the county. Congratulations. I think you're doing a good thing on that. And we're going to, you know, it's just a matter of time before all new buildings will be green buildings. How'd you like to build the last non-green office building in America? You know, you will lose, you know, non-green buildings are going to become considered Class B buildings. They will rapidly lose value in a world that's moving to green. But green and sustainable is about more than the vertical dimension. It's about more than what's going on inside the buildings. It's also about what's going on outside the buildings. It's about the land. It's about the horizontal dimension as well. Let me show you a couple of examples. Here are two streets I'm about to show you. This is a street in a new development in Middleton, Wisconsin. And here's a new development in Manassas, Virginia. Okay, which street would you rather live on? Okay, another question. Which street do you think the houses cost more money on? Which street is better for the environment? Which street is safer for children? All right, let's talk about the first one. You know, what the difference between these two streets is basically 16 feet of pavement in the width of the street. Guess what happens if you add 16 feet of pavement to the width of the street? Well, you've just increased the cost of every house along that street by $6,000 or $7,000 a house. Because streets are the single most expensive part of the development process. Stormwater is second. So more pavement means less affordable housing. It also means more soil erosion, more sedimentation, more non-point source pollution running off into our rivers and streams. 1 acre of asphalt will generate 16 times as much runoff as 1 acre of meadow. Now, isn't that interesting? You know, here's something, less pavement, that's both good for the environment and good for business. But what's happened in so many places in this state and around the country is if a developer came in and says to the local Board of Supervisors or the Planning Committee says, I'd like some flexibility in their street standards. People look at them like they're nuts, like they're trying to put something over on them. But suppose they went in with the local watershed organization or the local land trust and they said the exact same thing. Then they get a totally different hearing, right? Because people are now thinking, well, oh, it's not only good for business, it reduces the cost of housing, and it's good for the environment. And by the way, which one of those streets is safer for children? Well, it's been turned out that the 24-foot wide street has been empirically proven to be at least 4 times safer than the 40-foot wide street. Why? Because the wider the streets are, the faster the cars go. So here's just one small example of something that's good for business, good for the environment, good for the community. Less asphalt. Okay, let's look at a couple of other examples. I'm going to show you two other streets. You need to know that the houses on these two streets are identical. They're the exact same houses. First question, which street would you rather live on, this street or this street? They're the exact same houses, ladies and gentlemen. Next question, which street do you think has higher property values, this street or this street? Next question, which street do you think has lower utility bills, this street or this street? All right, let's look at these. Did you know that there are literally hundreds of studies that show that trees increase the value of residential property? And if you cut down all the trees around a piece of property, you can actually reduce the value of that property in some cases as much as 25 to 30%. Turns out, ladies and gentlemen, dollars do grow on trees. And what about this issue of your utility bill? Did you know that the temperature there on a hot summer day can be 9 degrees hotter than the temperature here in the same city? 9 degrees hotter. What does that mean for your air conditioning bill? Well, that means your air conditioning bill will go up by a minimum of 30%. Trees, good for business, good for the environment, good for the community. Let's talk about commercial development. Would you prefer to shop at a shopping center heavily landscaped with trees and bushes, or would you prefer to shop here? Now, I'm asking you this as a rhetorical question, clearly, but I've been asking this all over America for more than 25 years. The first place I ever asked this was a place called Baldwin County, Alabama. That's the southernmost county in the state of Alabama. It's the epitome of what you'd imagine the Deep South to look like. Huge live oak trees with Spanish moss. Beautiful houses on bluffs overlooking the Mobile Bay. Now, it used to be very hard to get from Mobile on the west side of Mobile Bay to the east side of the bay, because the only way to get there was across a causeway at the mouth of the Mobile Tensaw Delta. That was at sea level, and it flooded all the time. So there wasn't much development there until they built Interstate 10 about 25 or 30 years ago now. And Interstate 10 is elevated about 15, 18 feet above the water. And so all of a sudden, all this development starts pouring out of Mobile, Alabama, into Baldwin County, Alabama. And there's a road that goes from the interstate highway in the north called I-10, called US 98, goes from I-10 to the Gulf of Mexico in the south end of the county. And people started coming in from out of state, buying up all the frontages along US 98 and cutting down all the live oak trees. Now, as you can imagine, there are some people who lived there all their lives who got kind of upset about this. And so they went to the mayors of three towns, Montrose, Alabama, Fairhope, Alabama, and Daphne, Alabama, and they said, "We need a tree ordinance." And they go, "A tree ordinance? What's that?" They said, "Well, we want to save big live oak trees over a certain diameter in the parking lot of shopping centers." That's all they wanted to do. Now, you might have thought they had proposed the end to Western civilization as we know it by proposing this. And the people who are against this are saying things like, "Well, no one will go to the grocery store anymore if there's a tree in front of it." Like, what? I didn't really understand that. It was like, what, you wouldn't want to eat anymore if there's a tree in front of the grocery store? You'd forget where the grocery store was? What? But it was very controversial, as these things tend to be. So somebody said to me, "Well, what do you think we should do?" And I said, "Well, why don't you just ask people what you think?" So you got to remember, this is South Alabama. Do you have any idea how hot it gets in South Alabama in the summer? So they went over to the University of South Alabama in Mobile, and they hired them to conduct a countywide public opinion poll to ask a whole bunch of questions, including the exact question I just asked you a minute ago. They said, "Would you prefer to shop in a shopping center heavily landscaped with trees and bushes, or one without any?" And what do you think people said? By a margin of 92% to 4, with 4% undecided, people said they preferred trees to asphalt. And they did pass those tree ordinances, the first one in the history of the state of Alabama. And that began a decade-long discussion of the relationship between community character and economic development. How many people have ever been to Fairhope, Alabama, or Baldwin County? It's one of the very few places in Alabama where lots of people move to retire. And it's all about quality of life, ladies and gentlemen. It's about quality of life. Something I'll come back and talk to in a minute. Now, you don't believe me. We do studies on this kind of stuff at ULI. And some years ago, we did a nationwide study on the value of trees and landscaping to commercial development. We looked at projects all over America, and we found that trees and landscaping increased the value of commercial development in 8 different ways. I've listed 4 of them here. They increased the rate of financial return from 5 to 15%. They increased the rate of project absorption, means you lease your stores out faster. They improve employee productivity, morale, and job satisfaction. They help developers win support for proposed projects, especially in contentious situations. You want to get everybody upset? Cut down all the trees. You know, I teach a course for ULI called the Practice of Environmentally Sensitive Development. It's a course for builders. And it's, we always have a builder who will show up, but who will say, "It's just cheaper to cut the trees down. We can plant some when we're done." I say, "Yeah, it is cheaper. But do you know the difference between cost and value? It may cost you a little more to save the trees, but you'll more than make it up in the increased sales value of the house at the end of the project." You know, Mark Twain used to say a cynic was a man who knew the cost of everything and the value of nothing. We need to think a little more about the value of investing in our communities. Now let's talk about this issue of what a community looks like. Let's start with its front door, its gateway. And just like with meeting a person, a good first impression is important and a bad first impression is hard to change. Do you think you'd rather visit the town of Franklin, Tennessee, or the town of Midfield, Alabama? Which one looks more like a community with a sense of pride and a sense of place? Which one looks more like a community you would rather invest time or money in? Ladies and gentlemen, if you don't remember anything else I say tonight, remember this. The image of a community is fundamentally important to its economic well-being. I want to repeat that. The image of a community is fundamentally important to its economic well-being. What do I mean by that? What I mean simply this is this. Every single day in America, people make decisions about where to live, where to invest, where to vacation, where to retire, based on what our communities look like, what they look like. Let me give you a couple of examples. Well, first, I mean, some of you have probably read some of the works by Richard Florida, like the creative class or his new book, The Great Reset. Talks about how people think of a place as less tangible but more important than just about anything else. How about tourism? You know, tourism is kind of important because that's the biggest industry in the world. It's one of the biggest industries in Florida, and it's the first, second, or third largest industry in every single American state. You know, this is, I don't know if you can see this in the back, but this is the official travel guide for the state of Oregon. Their slogan is, Oregon, things look different here. Can you imagine a Virginia State tourism brochure that said, Virginia, things look the same here? Of course not, because what is tourism? It's about visiting places that are different, unusual, and unique. The more Charlottesville, Virginia comes to look just like every place else in America, the less reason there would be to come here. On the other hand, the more a community does to enhance its distinctive character, whether that's architectural, natural, cultural, what have you, the more people want to go there, because that's exactly what tourism is. If every place was just like every place else, there'd be no reason to go any place. The image of a community is fundamentally important to its economic well-being. And I don't know, people say, well, beauty is in the eye of the beholder. Well, really? You think so? Let me ask you this. Do you think this scenic view has more value, or do you think that scenic view has more value? Let me tell you what some of the leading economists in the world say about this topic. They say, quote, you can put a dollar value on a view. Scenic landscapes are an economic asset, not just because you and I think they're nice, but because other people are willing to pay to see the view and to experience the unique character of a place. They go on to say, quote, housing, hotels, offices with scenic views always command premium prices. The better the view, the higher the price. I mean, think about this. You go to the beach in the summer, right? And you rent a hotel room with a view of the ocean. You're going to pay more for that room than the exact same room on the other side of the hotel. What are you paying for? You're paying for the view. The scenic landscapes of Albemarle County have quantifiable economic value, which is just one of the reasons why some of those landscapes are worth preserving. You know, we've sort of figured that out in the development industry. You know, some years ago, the home builders were trying to figure out, well, what would it, that would add value to a house more than anything else? Was it the kitchen, the garage, a Viking stove? What was it? You know what they found? They found, quote, the surrounding environment is the single most important factor affecting the market value of a home. A mountain vista or proximity to a park, water, or green space affects the value of a home more than the size of the house, the number of rooms, the type of appliances, or even the presence of a swimming pool. The surrounding environment is the single most important factor affecting the market value of a home. Now, I don't know how many people saw this study that was reported on in the New York Times, the Washington Post, and other places recently, but it's based on a three-year series of public opinion polls conducted by the Gallup Organization in partnership with the Knight Foundation. They found that people's love for a community was a stronger indicator of economic growth than almost any other factor. More than low taxes or regulatory relief or anything. Loving a community. Well, isn't that interesting? And they found that love of a community was determined by three things. Social offerings, the openness of a community, and the beauty of a community. And communities that cared about those three things were economically stronger than those communities that did not care about those three things. All right, let's just switch and talk about something very non-controversial, something I know no one here has ever gotten upset about, controlling outdoor signs. I just want to say a few words about this. I know somebody had said this was might be an issue down here, so I wanted to talk about the Hooters and the Toys R Us for a few minutes. You know, okay, now don't get me wrong. We need signs. Signs give us direction and needed information. And a business sign can be colorful, a business sign can be decorative, a business sign can even be distinguished. Yes, that is a McDonald's hamburger sign. So what's the problem? The problem is too often signs are oversized. They're poorly planned. They're badly located. I mean, do we really want the gas station signs to be taller than the church steeples in our communities? Really? I mean, what does that say about us? Really, think about that. Gas station signs taller than church steeples. And finally, most of all, they're too numerous. Now I want to ask you what's wrong with this picture. I want to suggest to you there are three things wrong with this picture. Number one, it's ugly. Number two, it's expensive. And number three, it doesn't work. Okay, let's talk about each of those in turn. Image, cost, effectiveness. Okay. Here is the exact same spot on the exact same street. Okay? On the left is a before, on the right is an after. Same spot, same street. Think about the image that those two pictures project. Signs will project the image of a community faster than almost anything else. What do you want the image of your community to be? Classy or trashy? Tacky or quaint? Ordinary or special? Beautiful or ugly? Signs of the community will project its image faster than almost anything else. Let's talk about another thing. Let's talk about cost. Welcome to Highlands, North Carolina. All the signs in Highlands look like this, right? Anybody here ever been on vacation in Highlands, North Carolina? Let me see a show of hands. Yeah, a number of you, okay? All right, now, here's another sign. This is where I grew up, Bessemer, Alabama. Anybody here ever been on vacation to Bessemer, Alabama? Okay, now, which one of these signs costs more money? You think that sign's more expensive or this sign? Well, this sign, ladies and gentlemen, is about 10 times more expensive than the little one in Highlands, North Carolina. Which brings me to the next question, which is called effectiveness. Okay, here's a Harris Teeter sign in Litchfield Beach, South Carolina. Let me show you another Harris Teeter sign somewhere else in South Carolina. Which one of those signs is more effective? We say, well, that's a much bigger sign. That's got to mean, you know, I can see you. You're driving down the road and go, oh, I need to buy more groceries because the sign is bigger. That's how it works, right? If you had a 12-foot sign, you'd spend more money in the grocery store than if you had a 10-foot sign, right? Or 20-foot sign, you'd spend twice as much, right? No. So now let's try to find the sign in now. Okay, now you're driving down the street at 40 miles an hour. You can't see anything. And the reason is because it, of course, is empirically impossible to absorb the overload of information on a cluttered commercial strip like this. And you say, well, I know people say to me, well, okay, well, if that's the case, then why do people have all these signs? I'll tell you why they have them. It's called the copycat logic of competition. You know, you got a big sign, so then a man wants a bigger sign. Then he wants some flags and some pennants and some banners and some streamers. And before you know it, you are advertising to airplanes instead of to people. You know, everybody in this room can hear me talking, but if everybody was talking at once, nobody could hear anybody. That's exactly the way clutter works. If you turn down the volume, every voice becomes distinct. Businesses will do a better job of selling at less cost because people can now actually see what it is they're looking for. By the way, this is one of the four American states that does not have a single billboard: Vermont, Maine, Alaska, Hawaii. Okay? Did you know that Vermont has the largest bike touring industry in America? Not because it's the flattest state. No, it's because it's a state that, you know, people think beauty matters. Okay? And that's their tourism ad. There are no billboards in Vermont. Here's why. All right, let's talk about green space. Green space and property values. Another relationship between community character and economic value. Okay, you know, once again, there are literally hundreds of studies that document the relationship between green space and increased property values. Let me just give you an example. Do you know where the most valuable land in all of New York State is? There it is. It's the land next to Central Park. Okay, well, that's probably not a surprise to most people. But, you know, think about the way green space works. We have about 16,000 green space developments in America. We call them golf course developments. Okay? And, you know, what's interesting about golf course developments is that, did you know that the vast majority of buyers in golf course developments do not play golf? You know that nationwide, more than 65% of buyers in golf course developments do not play golf. So if you were to interview those people and say, well, why'd you buy the house there? I'll tell you what they'll say. They'll say, oh, I like the view across the fairway. I like to live next to protected open space. Well, duh. What does it cost to build a golf course? Like millions of dollars. What does it cost to maintain a golf course? Like millions of dollars. Like, what does it cost to leave the open space alone in the first place? Like, almost nothing. So a growing number of developers are starting to figure out that they could build a golf course development without the golf course. It's what we call a conservation development. And what can you do there? Okay, you can play ball, you can throw a frisbee, you can have a picnic, you can walk your dog, do anything you want. What can you do on a golf course? You can play golf. That's it. Now, I got nothing against golf. I'm sure there are golfers in the room. But let me tell you what the Wall Street Journal said about golf on a front page story 2 years ago. They said we're completely overbuilt on golf in America. Why? Because we have about 3 million people a year take up the game of golf in America. That's a lot of people. 3 million people a year take up the game of golf in America. Guess what? 3 million people a year quit the game of golf in America. Why? It's too time consuming, too difficult, and too expensive for many people. We built all these golf course developments because people figured out they could charge a premium for a house next to a golf course. You know, we can charge a premium for a house next to protected open space, which is another reason why it's worth preserving some of your open space. It creates value. It gives people a place to outdoor recreate, do all kinds of things, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You know, it's interesting, the home builders and the realtors, they did this study trying to figure out what features people would like most like in a new house community. Look at the top, walking trails and bike paths. Look at the bottom, golf courses, 6%. This is when they started building walking trails. They figured out, well, hey, that's a low-cost amenity that more people like. You know, and I congratulate you on your greenway system here in Charlottesville. What's the most popular form of outdoor recreation in America? Walking for pleasure, number one. If you built a public golf course in a typical community in America, you know how many people would use it on average, a public golf course? 1% to 2% of people in the community. You know how many people use a public golf, a swimming pool in a community? On average, 7% to 8% of people in the community. You know how many people use a public pathway system? 50% to 60% of people in the community. Why? Because anybody can use it. Young, old, able-bodied, disabled, mothers with strollers, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. All right. Let's talk about this for a second. Let's talk about historic buildings and landscapes and why that is important. You know, some of you have probably read some of Tom Wolfe's famous novels like Look Homeward, Angel. You know, Tom Wolfe, he penned this immortal line, you can't go home again. Well, sadly, Tom Wolfe, he can't go home again because here's the site of his original house in this parking lot in Asheville, North Carolina. Ladies and gentlemen, why is historic preservation important? I'll tell you why. First and foremost, because these are the places that physically connect us to the past. These are the places that tell us who we are and where we came from. As Daniel Webster once wrote, he said, quote, "The man who feels no sentiment or veneration for the memory of his forefathers is himself unworthy of kindred regard and remembrance." At its essence, saving the historic buildings of Virginia is about saving the heart and soul of Virginia. But ladies and gentlemen, it's also incredibly important to the economic well-being of Virginia as well. Let me give you a couple of examples. This used to be a fire station in a little small town in southern Indiana, Madison, Indiana. It became obsolete as a fire station. The guy bought it and turned it into a pizza parlor. And like so many small towns in America, this was a town going downhill. So they brought in something called the Main Street Program, a very powerful tool for economic revitalization. And one of the tenets of the Main Street Program is to facade restoration. Okay, and so they restored the facade of that building, physically connecting people to the roots in the past. But guess what else happened? Did you know that the sales of pizza almost doubled and sustained that over a multi-year period? Let me show you a couple of nationally famous examples. Of course, everybody in the room knows that Williamsburg is the number one tourist attraction in Virginia. What's the number one tourist attraction in Louisiana? Well, it's the French Quarter, of course. You know, I was involved with a team of planners and designers and architects who went down to New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina, and the city had asked us to put together an economic recovery plan. And, of course, we said to them, well, we need to know what the big economic drivers are in the city. What's the biggest industry in Louisiana? Is it the oil industry, the seafood industry, the sugar industry, the chemical industry? They said, no, it's none of those things. The biggest industry in the state of Louisiana is the tourism industry. And that is the economic engine of that industry. That is more valuable and more important than any plant, factory, or distribution center. But for years, they tried to nickel and dime that to death. They tried to put a freeway through the middle of that. tried to tear down half of those buildings. People didn't appreciate the value, the economic value of the most important economic asset in the entire state of Louisiana. Another example, let's go over to San Antonio, Texas. Let's visit the San Antonio Riverwalk. That is the most visited place in the state of Texas. That's the basis of that city's multi-billion dollar a year annual tourism industry. What most people don't know, however, is that at one point in the past, the city of San Antonio thought so little of that small river, they actually seriously tried to drain it and put it underground into a culvert. Today, it's the most visited place in the state of Texas. Let's fly out west. Let's go across the country to Seattle, Washington, and visit the Pike Place Farmers Market. This is the number one destination in the entire state of Washington. It gets about 6 million visitors a year. But did you know that seriously, about 25 years ago, a number of members of the Seattle City Council seriously proposed tearing down the Pike Place Market? Why? They said, oh, we need more downtown parking. Like parking for what? You can have all the parking in the world. If there's nothing to do, no one's ever going to want to go there. Now they love and revere this place and recognize it for the economic engine that it is. You know, we do these things in ULI called advisory service panels. We go all over the country and work with cities on various issues. And one of the places we worked with not too long ago was Buffalo, New York, and they were really concerned about downtown parking. So we did a study of downtown Buffalo. It turns out 50% of downtown Buffalo is surface-level parking. We said, hey, guys, your problem is not enough parking. Your problem is not enough buildings. You need to build something. You wish you had a parking problem. All right, how about Florida? Yes, Disney World is the number one destination in Florida. What's the number two destination you're looking at? It's called the Art Deco Historic District in South Miami Beach. You know, all those buildings were going to be torn down. There was like people saying, well, we've got to have more 15-story condos in South Florida. Anybody been to South Florida recently? Got a lot of empty 15-story condos. But we have nothing like South Beach, one of the greatest urban places in North America. People come from all over the world to visit this place. Or how about let's go to Baltimore, the Camden Yards Baseball Stadium. It was probably the most successful, most widely emulated sports stadium ever built in North America. Not because it was simply a new stadium. But first of all, because it was the first new baseball stadium that went downtown. And second, it was the first of the so-called retro stadiums. It did the best job of integrating the historic neighborhood and buildings into the historic neighborhood. It was a good neighbor. It became the model for all baseball stadium development in America. You know, and I'm not saying every community in America has got buildings worth preserving, and a lot of them are buildings you wouldn't really think about, like the Elephant in Margate, New Jersey, the Wigmon Motel in Holbrook, Arizona. You know, we've all got places that are worth preserving that physically connect us to the roots in the past. And by the way, I love this quote from Arthur Frommer, America's leading travel writer, says, among cities and towns with no particular recreational appeal, those that preserve their past continue to enjoy tourism. Those that haven't receive almost no tourists at all. Tourists simply won't go to a city or town that's lost its soul. Saving the soul of a community is pretty important to its economic well-being. And it goes well beyond tourism, ladies and gentlemen. This is an economic development magazine, basically for industrial park developers, called Southern Business and Development. Look at the headline, when site searching the South, make sure you inspect the communities downtown first. Why in the world would an industrial park developer care about a community's downtown? They're not going to build the industrial park downtown. Well, because they've kind of figured out that it's hard to be a suburb of nothing. You know, the apple rots from the inside out. Same thing with cities. If you don't have a healthy downtown, you don't have a healthy town. The downtown is the heart and soul of any community. It's one of the reasons why it's worth investing in. Now, I know most people in this room are in favor of preserving the best of the past, but I want to ask you this question. What are we building in Virginia today that will be worth preserving in the future? What buildings will your children and your grandchildren fight to save 50 years from now? Now, I ask that question for a couple of reasons. First of all, because 80% of everything ever constructed in America has been built since the end of World War II. 80% of everything. And a lot of it's just plain junk, like this Kentucky Fried Chicken franchise with the red plastic mansard roof that replaced a house very similar to the one you see in the background. It's also important because, as Winston Churchill once wrote, he said, quote, we shape our buildings and then our buildings shape us. What did he mean by that? What I think he meant is that the physical character of our communities affects who we are as a people, as a nation. It affects whether we can even have a sense of community. So I think we need to think a lot more about this question. How do we get new construction that enhances community character? We live in a nation of highly varied history, climate, culture, and terrain. And so many of our communities look like they're being built with Legos, interchangeable parts. Ask yourself this question. Do you think every chain store and every franchise in America has to look exactly alike, whether it's in Maine or Maryland, Missouri, Montana, or Albemarle County, Virginia? The answer to that, ladies and gentlemen, is no, of course not. Any building can fit in with your community. That is a new McDonald's. It's a little town called New Hyde Park, New York. It's in eastern Long Island. Prospective brides go there to pose for their bridal photographs. Not something you'd say every day about a McDonald's in America, now is it? But I want to tell you something. This is going on all over America. And, you know, you're an example. Here's one. This is Stowe, Vermont, a new McDonald's built from the ground up. It looks like a New England-style building. Why is that? Because it's in New England. Don't you think that buildings in one part of America ought to look different from buildings in another part of America? Shouldn't a McDonald's in New England look different from a McDonald's in the desert southwest? And shouldn't a new McDonald's in the southwest look different from a new McDonald's in the southeast? And shouldn't a new McDonald's in the southeast look different from a new McDonald's in the Midwest? These are all brand new buildings, ladies and gentlemen. And shouldn't a McDonald's in a small town like Annapolis, Maryland, look different from a McDonald's in a big city like St. Louis, Missouri? You know, this actually was built by a developer who realized that when food was no longer the novelty, and correct me if I'm wrong, are hamburgers still a novelty in America? He realized that good design could be. I'll tell you something about economic development, ladies and gentlemen. Sameness is not a plus. Sameness is a minus. Community differentiation is one of the single most important concepts in economic development today. If you can't differentiate Charlottesville from any other community, you have no competitive advantage. You know, you say, how do they do this? I'll tell you how they did this. They asked for this. If you accept off-the-shelf corporate cookie-cutter architecture, you're going to get it 100% of the time. If you insisted on something better, you can get that 100% of the time. Now, I'm not telling you it's always easy. You know it's not always easy. Where's Mary Joyce Gallo? She didn't tell you it's not always easy. But you know, I tell you, this is going on all over America and all over the world. This is the first McDonald's in America that went into an historic building. That's in Freeport, Maine. That's called the Gore Building. It was built in 1833. In 1980, McDonald's optioned that corner with the intention of demolishing that building and put up their typical crapola McDonald's, suburban-style McDonald's. The town of Freeport said, no, 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 we have a better idea. Why don't you restore the building? You can put a nice kitchen facility on the back as an addition. McDonald's was not thrilled about this. This was 31 years ago. So they sued the town of Freeport, and they lost. And then they sued the town of Freeport a second time, and they lost again. But guess what? 3 years later, a picture of that McDonald's appeared in their annual corporate report as an example of their good community stewardship. And I want to tell you, they're not suing anybody for this anymore. They're doing this all over the world, but only in communities that are savvy enough to say, I want something that fits with my town. I don't want your off-the-shelf model. What you need to know is that every chain store and every franchise in America has Plan A, Plan B, and Plan C. And what gets built depends on you. Depends on you. You know, you have the power, as the Good Witch of the West said in Wizard of Oz, you've always had the power. You know, here's a typical Plan A Pizza Hut. You've got one just like it up the street. Okay? You want to see Plan B? Then all you got to do is ask. They'll give you the brown roof. What do you want? Brown roof, red roof? Up to you. Okay? Try a little harder. You get Plan C. And by the way, every Plan C is different because every place is different. And it can apply to anything. Like, here's your off-the-shelf Rite Aid. Let me show you a couple other Rite Aids. Here's a brand new Rite Aid. That is not an historic building. That's a brand new Rite Aid in the town of Camden, Maine. Here's a Rite Aid, Washington, D.C., the corner of 14th and U. Here's a typical off-the-shelf CVS, okay? Here's another CVS, okay? That's in Lakeland, Florida. Okay, how about this one? Alexandria, Virginia. How about this one? Mashpee, Massachusetts. How about this one? Washington, D.C., on MacArthur Boulevard, in the old MacArthur Theater. Looks just like any other CVS inside. You know, but on the outside, they save the marquee, they save the ticket window, they save the movie theater, they save the neighborhood's identity. You can do this too. How about a Lowe's or a big box retailer like a Home Depot? Well, here's another Lowe's, Gaithersburg, Maryland. Or a Kmart, here's another one. This is Jackson, Wyoming. It's got clock towers at both ends, articulated roof line, wooden front, a drive-through. Okay, how about Walmart? Okay. Well, you know, it used to be just the gray-blue battleship box. That's all you get. Now, I'll tell you a quick story. About 8 years ago now, there was a terrible tornado went through the town of La Plata, Maryland, and it tore down the downtown. It also tore down the Walmart. And La Plata said, adversity can breed opportunity, and when we build back, we want to build back better. That means you too, Walmart. So Walmart built that. It's not an outstanding building, but it was the beginning of a trend. And no longer have to do this. As you go, if you just go see the new Walmart in Greene County, just as an example, you know, they don't have to do that anymore. So they're doing this all over America. Here's Orlando, and here's Evergreen, Colorado, and here's Los Angeles, and here's what the future of Walmart is, ladies and gentlemen. There's only one place with more spending power than stores to spend it in. You know where that is? It's our downtowns. You know, we have more than 1 billion square feet of vacant retail space in America right now, ladies and gentlemen. It's out on the strip, almost all of it. There's only one place in America with more spending power than stores to spend it in. It's called our downtowns. Walmart just announced they're going to build their first ever Walmarts in Washington, D.C. But they're not going to be your typical Walmarts. First one will be on New Jersey Avenue Northwest, okay? It will be in a five-story building with 315 apartments on top, with parking underneath in an 80,000-square-feet building. What is a big-box retailer anyway? It's what we used to call a department store, okay? Here's a Target in downtown Stamford, Connecticut. Five-story building. First floor is locally owned retail. Next two floors are parking. Top two floors are Target. Here's the flagship Target. You know, Target had the we Avis, we try harder mentality, so there's over 200 multi-store Targets now. Like, the big issue for, you know, big boxes used to be, well, how do we get the shopping carts from the first floor to the second floor? Well, I mean, we did figure out how to put somebody on the moon, right? We could probably figure out how to get the shopping carts up and down, and they did. There's an escalator. If you've been in a multi-story Target, there's an escalator for your shopping cart. It comes down right next to you. And then how about this concept, like mixing uses? Oh, I know that's a scary concept. You know, but some people do like the idea of sleeping upstairs and shopping downstairs, particularly some of the 75% of American households who do not have school-aged children. You say, well, what could mixed use look like in a small Virginia town? Well, here's what it looks like. It's a new Dairy Queen in Herndon, Virginia, okay? Has a dentist office upstairs. How appropriate. You know, I mean, really, think about it. Who would you rather live next door to anyway, a house full of out-of-control teenagers or a dentist office? Which one's going to have a greater impact on your quiet enjoyment? It's not the use. It's the impact of the use that we should be thinking about. And that gets us to the final things I want to say. What are the secrets of successful communities in America? We have 37,000 incorporated communities in America, ladies and gentlemen. We have over 3,500 counties. Okay, how many of those communities would you really say are successful communities? 1,000, 2,000, 3,000? You know, maybe 5,000, I don't know. But then we got another 30,000 that aren't particularly successful. What's the difference? Ladies and gentlemen, first and foremost, successful communities have a plan for the future, have a vision for the future. Now, I grew up in Alabama, and I tell you, Rick Middle can tell you about this too, and planning used to be a dirty word in Alabama. You go home, people say, oh, I'm against planning. And you know what I say to them? I say, okay, then you tell me the name of any successful organization, institution, corporation, or community that doesn't plan for the future. Failing to plan simply means planning to fail. As the book of Proverbs says, without vision, the people will perish. Successful communities always have a vision for the future. And those visions begin by inventorying your assets. And then successful communities build all their plans, whether it's an economic development plan, a land use plan, a tourism plan, what have you, around the enhancement of their existing assets. Economic development today, ladies and gentlemen, is a lot more about what you do have than it is about what you don't have. You know, for too long in America, people thought it was always the one big thing. Like, okay, convention centers. First, we had to have this arms race to build the biggest convention center in America, right? But I tell you, no one's ever going to have bigger convention centers than Orlando or Atlanta or Las Vegas or Chicago. So you're not going to win that arms race if you're Cleveland or Canton or Akron. So, you know, what did Cleveland do? They could have tried to compete with Chicago, but they said, well, what is our asset? It's the Cleveland Clinic. So maybe we should build a smaller convention center focused on medical conventions and build a medical mart. That's building on their assets. You know, and then it was festival marketplaces. Everybody had to have a festival marketplace after they had one in Boston and Baltimore. And you know, we built 23 festival marketplaces that went bankrupt, including the one in downtown Richmond and the one in downtown Toledo and many others. And then it was aquariums. Everybody had to have an aquarium, right? So I mean, even in downtown Camden, New Jersey, they said if we could spend $700 million building an aquarium featuring the fish of New Jersey, those are little small brown fish with lesions on them. No, I'm serious. I don't really. But they did build a literally $600 million aquarium. It's a wonderful aquarium, but did it save downtown Camden? No, it did not. Camden's still a disaster. Because it's never the one big thing. It's lots of little things working synergistically together off of a plan that makes sense for you and your community. Successful communities use education, incentives, partnerships, and voluntary initiatives, not just regulation. You know, I understand Teddy Roosevelt used to say, you know, you can get a lot more done with a smile and a six gun than a smile alone. But his buddy Mark Twain would retort, yes, but if the only tool you have is a hammer, then every problem starts to look like a nail. You'll never build a great community with regulation alone. You got to use incentives. You got to use partnerships. You got to use voluntary initiatives. Now, I didn't say I'm against regulation. Regulation is important. It prevents bad things from happening. It sets a minimum standard of conduct. But you never will create a great community by regulation alone. Successful communities pick and choose among development proposals. Ladies and gentlemen, all development is not created equal. Some development will make Albemarle County a better place to live in, to look at, to work in, to visit. Some development won't. You know what the biggest impediment to better development in the South is today, ladies and gentlemen? I'll tell you what it is. It's a fear of saying no to anything. Well, if you're afraid to say no to anything, then you'll get the worst of everything. Communities that set no standards or low standards will compete to the bottom. Communities that set high standards will compete to the top. And if you say no to bad development, you will always get better development in its place. Successful communities cooperate with their neighbors for mutual benefit. Successful communities consider what they look like, as well as ecology and economics. Successful communities have strong leaders and committed citizens. You know, and I know it's not always easy getting things done in communities. Now, I don't know if people have ever been out to Buena Vista, Virginia, in the valley. There's a little sign going to town that says, "Welcome to Buena Vista, home of 6,002 happy citizens and three old grouches." And it kind of sums up life in any Virginia community, because no matter what you're for, there will always be some people who are against it. And there's some people I call the againers. They're against everything. Always tell you why it can't be done, why it costs too much, why it shouldn't be done, why it can't happen. But I tell you, ladies and gentlemen, pessimism and no is a very powerful word. But you know what's a more powerful word? Yes. Yes, we can make this a better place to live in, to look at, to work in, to visit. A pessimist sees difficulty in every opportunity. An optimist sees opportunity in every difficulty. Ladies and gentlemen, you can grow without destroying the things that people love. Thank you very much for having me here tonight.
Thank you very much, Ed. My name is Brian Wheeler. I'm Executive Director of Charlottesville Tomorrow. I want to thank Ed for a wonderful presentation. I'm sure many of you have questions ready to go or comments ready to go for Ed. But we're going to give the first opportunity to our panelists, who I'd like to invite to come on up at this point. And while they're coming up and getting settled, I want to thank the committee that helped pull this off tonight. Megan Welsh, thank you. Angela Lynn, and my wife, Jean Wheeler. Let's give them a round of applause. I also want to thank Steve Suddeth and the Omni Hotel for their support and hospitality tonight. And now let me introduce the panel. Each one of them is going to get a few minutes to respond to what they've heard tonight. We're going to give them an opportunity to ask some questions, maybe among themselves, and then also take questions from the audience. Dennis Rooker, who's sitting next to Ed, is a member of the Albemarle County Board of Supervisors. He's represented the Jack Jewett District in Albemarle County since 2002. He served as chairman of the Board of Supervisors in Albemarle County in 2005 and 2006. Before being elected to the board, he was a member of the Albemarle County Planning Commission. He's also an attorney here in town. Galen Bates, at the end, is a founder of the Bates Corporation in 1987. His firm specializes in local residential and commercial development. Some of his development projects include Old Trail Village in Crozet, Redfields, and Mosby Mountain. Kim Tanzer moved to Charlottesville in 2009 to become the dean of the University of Virginia School of Architecture. And in two decades before coming to UVA, she was a professor and practicing architect at the University of Florida in Gainesville. And tonight, I said to Kim before the event, since she was an academic dean, she was probably used to herding cats, and that she would be our moderator. I'd greatly appreciate it. So Dean Tanzer will be our moderator tonight. And we'll go ahead and turn it over first to Dennis Rooker to make some comments, and then we'll hear from everybody and take your questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Brian. First of all, I just wanted to comment on Charlottesville Tomorrow. One of the things that makes this community unique are things like Charlottesville Tomorrow. I don't know of another community. I don't know of another community in the country that has anything exactly like Charlottesville Tomorrow. It's a terrific asset. And thank you, Brian and Michael, for what you've done here. I told my wife earlier tonight, I said, you're going to enjoy this presentation tonight. Ed McMahon is my hero. I have not heard Ed speak before, but I've seen his CDs, his DVDs, excuse me. And you can't help but get charged up and excited about your community when you hear Ed speak. And so thank you for the invigorating talk and also for shooting some adrenaline in the public officials that are here tonight. Most of the board members from the Board of Supervisors are here tonight. My wife, who's with me tonight, Ann, handed me an article the other day from the Washington Post. I usually read the Wall Street Journal, and she reads the Washington Post, and we cut articles out for each other and swap them back and forth. And the article is January 6th in the Washington Post. It was entitled, Sometimes Money Does Grow on Trees. And it said, more than 150 years ago, America's greatest landscape architect, Frederick Olmsted, created Central Park and changed New York forever. He went on to transform dozens of more cities, leaving a priceless legacy of vibrant, beautiful cityscapes. And in the process, he increased property values. Olmsted discovered this himself when he tracked the value of land around Central Park and found that the city's $13 million investment had led to an astounding $209 million increase in property values in that area in 17 years. The architect recognized what many planners still fail to grasp. Parks and managed green space are vital pieces of urban land infrastructure that not only improve the quality of life for millions of people, but also drive economic growth. And that's something we need to focus on. Certainly, it's invigorating to me to hear someone like Ed speak and talk about how and point out how the communities that have done the best job of preserving the quality of life in their community, of preserving green spaces, on building on the advantages they have. Here we've got the advantages of the beautiful mountain vistas, the history of Monticello, the University of Virginia, and those things are bricks to build on that most communities don't have to start with. We are so fortunate. And when you look at the list of economic indicators in the state and in the country, Albemarle County is usually economically one of the best places. We almost always have one of the lowest employment rates in the state and in the nation. We're often about half of the unemployment rate of the nation. We have you know, we're one of the 30 counties in the country that has a AAA bond rating, the smallest county in the country that has a AAA bond rating. And that's not necessarily something that the public officials have created here. It's because values have stayed high in this area because of the high quality of life that is first afforded by the natural advantages we have and has been helped by some of the things that people that have come before me have done. There's no question that good planning enhances economics and quality of life for citizens. One of the things that we have done over the years that I'm sure you followed in the newspaper is we decided about 10 years ago we were going to master plan all of our growth areas. 5% of the land in the county is roughly is in the growth areas, and the other 95% is rural area land. And we have recognized that, you know, if you get a puzzle and you don't have a picture on the back of that puzzle, you're going to have no idea of how the pieces fit together. Master planning is the concept of developing that picture that's on the back of the puzzle box so that as pieces start being put in place, you have an idea of how they ought to fit together. We adopted about 10 years ago also something called the neighborhood model, and that's now part of our comprehensive plan. And the idea of that is to provide for pedestrian-friendly, mixed-use, walkable communities within our growth areas. That planning effort won a national award for our planning department. It now is somewhat incorporated in state law. State law now requires that communities set aside designated growth areas and that they plan for the development within those growth areas. So we were somewhat on the forefront of that in the state of Virginia. We enacted new subdivision ordinance to help implement the principles of the neighborhood model, to try to create streetscapes and new development that look more like Plan A than Plan B, as Ed put on the slides. You can see the difference between communities that have walkable streets, have street trees, have narrower streets, and those that don't. It's not only less expensive for developers often, it maintains values and creates the kind of quality of life that we want to see in our community. We have an architectural review board, which reviews all development that goes into our entrance corridors. Almost all of the major roads in our communities are entrance corridors. Dwayne Snow, who's on the board with me, served on the architectural review board before he came on the Board of Supervisors. If I had to pick out one thing over the last 15 years that has helped preserve the aesthetics of Albemarle County, I would say it was the development of the Architectural Review Board entrance corridor requirements. We have a sign ordinance, as most communities do. We are now looking at making some changes to the sign ordinance. Some of those I'm concerned about. When you look at communities like Beaufort, South Carolina, Hilton Head, South Carolina, which some of the illustrations which Ed used depicted, I think you can see that communities that have adhered to good sign design not only save their merchants money, but they make it easier for people to find things, and they also preserve the aesthetics of their community. And we need to make certain we continue to focus on doing those things. I have a lot more I could say, but I'll defer it right now. I will say that we need to we have many, many programs in the county where we have put in place things to preserve the environment, to protect the environment, to protect streams, protect groundwater, protect the night skies. And we need to build on those things to keep preserving what's unique about our community. And so I would, you know, the last thing on that list is if we're going to have a special community that's successful, we need to have strong leaders and committed citizens. And what I see tonight are committed citizens that can make that happen. They're the same kind of committed citizens that have helped create what we have here today. And so we need to make certain that we continue on the role to preserving and protecting the soul of our community, because this community has a very strong and beautiful soul.
Thank you.
Well, as you might guess, when I arrived, I wondered what I was doing up here.
Being a developer has its challenges. Linda Bates and I decided to move to Charlottesville in 1984, and we chose Charlottesville for all the reasons we're talking about tonight. We had our checklist of what we wanted out of life, and we moved here to raise our children. And being a developer in Charlottesville is a challenge. My sweet Maggie Bates at age 8 came home from school and said, "Daddy, what do you do?" I said, "I'm a developer." She said, "Can we call that something else?" So from that perspective, I've worked with the county for now almost 30 years, developed some, I think, some projects I'm proud of, and everything I've done I've tried to be proud of. We were very fortunate to buy this magnificent piece of property in Crozet. The McNeelys, after Jay's death, actually selected me, and I felt honored to this minute that they have picked me. And they picked me because they didn't want me to screw it up. And I was happy that we had 900 units that we could put on this beautiful farm. And we no sooner began than our wise county said, "No, we have a neighborhood model we want you to consider." And I said, "Are you kidding me? You want me to build a new town in Crozet?" And 5 years later, we muddled through it, and I was the skeptic. I traveled to Florida. I saw failed shopping centers and town centers, and I came back and said, "What are we going to do in Crozet?" Well, this is not about me and my success, but it's about the vision of your county, because we tried it, we're doing it, we're proud of it. We have 287 current residents that love it, and this is my sales pitch, but this year we sold 70 houses. We did almost twice what we've ever done before. And it's because people want to live where it's beautiful, where we have walkability. Trails have always been one of my important strongholds. We have golf. Let's do a test. I want to see if 6% of you play golf.
No. Yeah. Galen, you probably have as much other open space as you do golf course.
We do. Yeah. We do. We just dedicated 45 acres to the county for Western Park. Very proud to do that. Someday when your funds are full again, we'll build a beautiful park there that we've already master planned with the county. But the idea that I'll never forget a meeting with Mr. Tony Vanderwalker, who's in this room. And he said, "I'm going to support you at Old Trail for this new rezoning." And I said, "Why?" He said, "Because I want to put everybody there and keep them out of our open spaces." So the point is, it's working. Our town center first phase is full. Our apartments above are full. Last month, 5 of those apartment dwellers bought houses at Old Trail because they came out, they test drove it, and they liked it. It is because of the vision of your planners, and it's just simply working. Of course, the view isn't bad either. I'm not the only one. Bob's Belvedere is another example of new urbanist planning, and until recently Hunter had one. But Biscuit Run is passed, and it helps us a lot. But anyway, I'm just being honest. And I wish him the best. But anyway, that's my little speech, is to tell you that it's working. It's working because it's good planning, and the marketplace is recognizing that.
Thank you. Well, I too kind of wonder what I'm doing up here, but I thank you for the invitation to be part of this group. And I have to say, I've been here for about a year and a half, and this is the first opportunity I've had to be part of the larger Charlottesville community rather than the University of Virginia community, and it feels very good to be here, so thank you for the invitation. I'd also like to say that this is such a wonderful event that I have not been a participant in Charlottesville Tomorrow, but my check will be in the mail. I want to thank those of you. I want to thank those of you who have contributed. It's obviously an important organization for the community. And I also want to put a plug in for an organization I am part of, which is the Charlottesville Community Design Center, co-located with Charlottesville Tomorrow. and I know some of my fellow board members are here, and I think that the Design Center also has a role to play in shaping the community. I wanted to just react to a few things that Ed said to us this evening and maybe just set up the opportunity for further discussion. First of all, I wanted to talk about a few assets that I recognize here as a relative newcomer to the community. As Brian said, I came from another university community, which is also full of people like me who know everything about whatever little part of the world we know about. And that can make for some challenging discussions. Having smart people can make it difficult, and I'm sure I'm in a room full of smart people. But what I see here, which is, I think, at least so far as I can tell, a little bit different from Gainesville, Florida, is there doesn't, at this moment, at least as I read it, seem to be the degree of polarity that I sense, that I know in my own community. You all may disagree, and we can discuss how polarized is polarized, but I think that I don't have a sense that positions are perhaps quite as hardened as they could be, and I see that as an asset for the community. And I certainly would like to play my part in helping to make sure that developers, and I kind of straddle the fence between conservationists and developers. All architects build things, and we build new things, and sometimes we have to cut down trees, although not big, beautiful, old live oaks, to do that, but I'm also a conservationist. So I think that one of the assets that Charlottesville has going for it is the fact that at least as compared to where I've come from, there is not the animosity that often comes to public meetings, and I think that's important. Another asset, as I mentioned informally, is that there are forums for discussion, and I hope that you all will take advantage of them. I probably don't even know of all of them yet, but certainly the Design Center, Charlottesville Tomorrow, and opportunities like this give us a way to get together and speak informally and develop that common vision. Ed mentioned Richard Florida, whose work I've read also, and Richard Florida writes about in his book, The Creative Class, the three T's, technology, talent, and tolerance. And he argues that university communities have an abundance of those things, and I think that that's equally, if not more, true of the University of Virginia Charlottesville community relative to the one that I came from. Technology is people who are good at and know a lot about what it sounds like. Technology talent is the people who came to the University of Virginia, the people who have stayed in after graduating from the University of Virginia, and in a community with the rich history that this community has, the people who have stayed probably go back a number of generations. And then tolerance is the third element, and that has to do with the open-mindedness that people who are educated have toward those who are different. That's people from different ethnic backgrounds, different from different cultural or religious backgrounds. And so I think that that's a real asset that it's important to keep in mind as the community moves forward. I wanted to set forward a few challenges that I hope I can, in my time as dean at UVA and as a member of our community, help to work on. And one is to think about, and I'd like for you to take a moment looking around at each other, at the people who are here, and ask yourselves who isn't here. And I ask that question because I think that, like Ed, I've traveled around the world. I'm sure many people have. And what I find interesting in communities is those who are multivalent, whose communities tell many stories, so that it's not just that one line you pop in, you see the great whatever it is, but the more you stay, the richer the story of that community gets. And I think that as this community builds its story, it will be important to make sure that everyone's voices are part of it, because I believe that they all help to make a richer sense of place. And I guess another way of saying that, and this is a challenge for you all, I'm a relative newcomer. It's easy. I've been here, of course. I'm, as a former architecture student, my first visit to Charlottesville was in the early 80s when, of course, I came to see Monticello and UVA. I'd studied them in school, and I visited them. I came back around 10 years ago pretty much for the same reason, and, of course, since I've been here, I see a lot more things. But still, I would urge the community to move beyond its icons. This is probably the only community in the United States, if not the only community in the world, with two UNESCO World Heritage Sites. That's extraordinary, and I know everyone in the room is incredibly proud of them, and I'm just at awe being here. But those are only two things, and they can't, I feel like as a newcomer, their prominence is almost overdeveloped as compared to other things that are more subtle and of the type that Ed mentioned that give richness to a community. And that leads me to a challenge which would be something that he spoke about, which is an inventory of assets. So I was making notes, because I'm an academic, of some of the things that I think one needs to inventory that he mentions. And that has to do with things like conservation areas. And I think in terms of maps, and I don't have these maps in my own head, some of you perhaps do, and I would challenge you to say that perhaps some of them haven't yet been created. We don't have everything on the back of the puzzle box to put the puzzle together yet. That would include where are the major conservation areas in the community and how do we foreground those for our own citizens as well as for people who come to visit. Not every street necessarily needs to be perfectly designed, but are there some that we think are incredibly important and we want to make sure that in planning the community we're reinforcing in terms of the way they're landscaped? Do they have multimodal transportation? Do they have bike paths and things, or can they? I know that's a challenge with really old roads. That's a challenge Florida doesn't often have to deal with since everything's relatively new there. The canopy, the value of trees within the urban infrastructure, what is the green infrastructure of the community? How can we reinforce that within neighborhoods as well as in that larger network that is the community as a whole? And I'm thinking primarily of Charlottesville, but the same would be true in Crozet or in Scottsville, other places like that. What are the gateways? Where are the first impressions made, and are we making the right ones? Are there views, vistas? Certainly you can see down from mountains and from hills. What do you see when you're in important places looking up or looking out? What are the places? I have one of my favorite authors writes about the secret places that we remember even if they don't show up on maps. What are the places that are loved by some subset of this community and probably not all the same places? It might be a swimming hole somewhere. It might be where something important happened in 1975 or 1875, but that still resonate for members of the community. Where are our green spaces and how can we protect those? I mentioned historic preservation in terms of those icons, but there are many, many buildings more than 100 years old that have incredible character. Some are prominent and some are really funky, but I think a lot would be of value. New buildings, of course, I care about. I'm sure many of you do. Can we make sure that we're building up to the standards that were built 150 years ago? The downtown is extraordinary here. How can we reinforce that in everything that we do? And then I guess the other thing that I would mention, and to end where Dennis ended, is the leadership in the community. And I'm too new here to understand who in this room are the leaders in this community. Maybe all of you are. But I would urge all of us to make sure that we're speaking when we can with one voice and reinforcing good ideas that come even from people we may have only some shared interest with as we move forward. So those are my thoughts in listening to remarks this evening. I think that my job is to let our panelists ask some questions or make further comments to each other and then to open the floor to the larger audience. So, any of my three panelists.
Just when you talked about green spaces, it reminded me that you know, we've had a real emphasis here on preservation of open spaces. We now have over 20% of the county is either in conservation easement or parkland. Over 80% of the county is still forested. Which is sometimes hard to believe, but when you look at the county from above as opposed to on the main roads where the development is, you see that, and that's something we need to strive to protect because trees are important for a huge number of reasons, as Ed brought out earlier. when you talk about diversity of leadership, you know, at the back of the room, I didn't see them when I came in, but several members of City Council are here. We have one table where we have the Executive Director of the Chamber of Commerce, a former head of the Architecture Review Board, the head of the United Way, two former mayors, former head of League of Women Voters, I believe, the head of the Economic Development Commission, and someone who's currently on the ARB, and they're from all political persuasions. So we have in the room a tremendous variety of really well-informed participating citizens. Questions?
Okay. Ed, before we open it up from the floor, would you like to make any more direct comments about the community or?
I want to mention one, I think, underutilized asset. I drove around today. I've been to Charlottesville, of course, many times and always see something new and saw a number of new things today. But one place that has always struck me as a place of missed opportunity, and I'm not sure the name of the street, but it's the street that runs from the university to downtown. Is that Main Street? That could be one of the great streets in Virginia, but it's not. It's like a lot of missing teeth. And if I were to say to the city of Charlottesville, you ought to be concentrating on creating some synergies that's between the downtown and the university. That, you know, if you go to Madison, Wisconsin, or you go to a lot of different places, they have a street like that. And there's room for a lot of density on that street. There's room for a lot of activity. There's room. You got a train station with a commuter line to Washington now. I mean, that ought to be one place that I think that could really stand some focus, and the university, I think, could play a big role in that. It's obviously better than it was 20 years ago, that'd be one comment I wanted to make on one thing I saw that sort of reminds me that I think about every time I come down here.
There's no one on City Council on this panel, but I'm sure if they came forward, they could tell you that they have spent a huge amount of time, effort, and money planning for what might take place in that corridor and interacting and working with the university and the university architect's office especially.
So I think it's time for questions or comments from the floor, and we've got some microphones, so if you raise your hand, we can amplify your question. And if you would give us your name when you
Ron
speak.
Thomas, Alwell County Supervisor. Galen, this question is for you. Since Ed was talking about golf courses aren't a come-on for development, what would you have done if you hadn't put a golf course in there?
Well, our situation was unique. One of the reasons we have a golf course is because I wanted to build one, but the real reason was that Jay McNeely's family asked that we build a course to Jay's honor. And so the only extra baggage that came with this gorgeous 700 acres was that I had to build a golf course. So that's the reason. Ed speaks to trying to maintain the culture and the feel of the neighborhood when you develop. One of our goals for Old Trail Golf Club was two. One is that if you knew the McNeely Farm or Billy White's Farm or the Ray Family Farm, which it all was, that you would still see the same farm. So we did not hire the golf course architects that push dirt and create these mounds and bunkers. And as a result, I think we did it. I think it looks like a farm with a beautiful golf course laying on it. So that plus we didn't put houses on our golf course. That's a crazy idea for developers, but we wanted golf to be unique to itself. So we have a few houses on the golf course, but mostly it is a core course where when you enjoy this experience, this walking experience, this frustrating experience, you're up against the mountains and you have a pretty good time. So
could you cut the rough a little shorter?
It has been mowed.
It
has been mowed.
I think Ed said only 6% of the people play golf, and only about 10% of that 6% are good golfers. This is one of them.
Yeah, I just want to, you know, I wasn't trying to knock golf. I just wrote a new book called Conservation Communities, Creating Value with Nature, Open Space, and Agriculture. And it's basically about the idea of how you use those three things to create value in development.
One of the things that there was just an article in Los Angeles Times talking about agriculture is the new golf. People love to live next to green space, and part of that is that, you know, it does cost a lot to operate a golf course, but you can actually sometimes make a positive cash flow by running a farm on the same property or a vineyard or a lot of other things. So there's, and the, I don't know how many people are aware of the carbon footprint of food. I mean, we as one writer likes to say, the era of the 2,000-mile Caesar salad is going to have to come to an end. So the idea of growing food closer to home also fits with that. So it wasn't the idea of that there's anything wrong with golf. It's the idea that there are other ways to create value in real estate.
Hi, Kim and Malik. I want to add one thing to Kim's long list of assets, which is wonderfully creative, but our natural diversity, our ecological treasures that we have in this county, we have places in the southern part of Batesville area where there are surviving chestnut trees from the blast. The blight, rare orchids, wonderful places that we can't recreate. And we need to preserve the assets that we have that can never be brought back. So that's something looking forward. And thank you for the segue on the local food, because those of us who are farming and create participants in the local food movement here, this is a way to provide a little extra income for the preservation of that open space.
Right.
And also provide wonderful food for people to eat. Thanks.
I'm Charlie Foster. I've been around for about 5 years. I'm from Richmond, but this question's for Ed, and it really has to do with what I call the blight of communities, one of which is signage and the other is above-ground telephone lines. But with regard to signage, what's been your experience with the Urban Land Institute as to how you undo some of that? I mean, what do communities do to improve the blight that's been created?
First of all, you know, that raises a larger question. A lot of times people say it's too late for us in a community, but some people say, like I talk about the franchise thing or signs, and a lot of times people say, well, it's just too late for us, and the answer to that question is it's never too late. Community character deteriorates one bad building and one ugly sign at a time, and it can get better one building and one sign at a time. And so, you know, the truth is it's never too late to start. And so, you know, you can't turn a community around overnight, but you can turn it around if you begin today. You know, George Bush Sr. used to say the best time to plant a tree was 25 years ago. The second best time is tomorrow. And I think that's the way you got to think about community redevelopment as well. I mean, sort of everything, you know, starts, you know, just give you an example. It's a little town in Northern California called Susan City, California. In 1989, it was voted the worst place to live in Northern California. Okay, they had a city hall that was two double-wide trailers. It was the only city hall in California registered with the Department of Motor Vehicles, right? And, you know, but here's a city that basically recognized that, you know, why would anybody invest in a community that wouldn't invest in itself? So they said, we need to set the standard. And so public buildings used to always set the standard in our communities. Public buildings were always, before World War II, they were always our most beautiful buildings. They were always downtown, whether it was the library, the public school, the courthouse, whatever. Okay. So they said, we're going to build a new city hall. And that building began a decade-long transformation of that city. It took a decade. And in 1999, they were voted one of the best places to live in Northern California. But it began with a small investment in themselves. It's the same thing, you know, who was the first place in the South to have monument-style signs? I'll tell you where it was, Chapel Hill, North Carolina, okay? Well, if you go to Chapel Hill now, every city around there, whether it's Carrboro or Cary or Raleigh or Durham, they all have monument-style signs, okay? And so the question is, well, you can either compete to the top or you can compete to the bottom, okay? Well, they decided they wanted to realize that, you know, sign clutter is ugly. It's expensive. It doesn't work, okay? And so they... One city passed an ordinance. Okay, what did they do in Carrboro? Well, they had a sign removal day. They used an incentive. Okay, they said, okay, we're going to provide the cranes, and we'll come out here and actually, and the sign guy actually makes more money because now he's selling them a new sign, right? And we get volunteers. We'll help take down the ugly signs, and we'll put up some nice new signs, and they've transformed that community as well. I mean, so it's never too late to begin, and I would suggest tomorrow's the time to start. So.
You know, an example of that locally is when the county passed its dark sky ordinance, we didn't require that all the existing lights be retrofitted, but all the new lights that came in from that point forward
had to be shielded downward. And it's had a tremendous impact in the 12-odd years, I guess, it's been in place.
You mentioned utility wires also. There's a community in Virginia that routinely undergrounds utility wires every time there's a new development. It's called Arlington, Virginia. Arlington, by the way, has the lowest unemployment rate in the United States of America. Every time they build a new building in Arlington on Wilson Boulevard, Columbia Pike, all the main thoroughfares, they underground the utility wires. You go to Arlington now, there's almost no utility wires left on any of the major things, but it's taken them 35 years to do that because it's expensive. But I want to mention one of the things about utility wires, because the utility companies always tell you, well, it's way too expensive to do this. Well, first of all, if you talk to the European utility companies, like in England, where all the wires are routinely undergrounded, they will tell you it costs a lot less than the American utility companies tell us, right? But the other big thing is what's called climate adaptation. You know, we are getting a lot more severe weather events, I can tell you that. And, you know, if your power is only going out because the wires are down once a year or twice a year, well, then maybe it's too expensive to underground. But sorry, if they go start going down six times a year or eight times a year, believe me, we're going to start undergrounding utility wires because the lost economic output from losing power for 4 days every time we have a big storm, we're going to have a lot more big storms going forward. And so it's going to become more important to do that for that reason, if no other. Thank you.
I think another good example of that little bit at a time is what you see on the downtown mall. I mean, how long ago did you go to the downtown mall project start? That was back in the 70s, so it's been 35 years or so now. And we have people sitting here who voted on that project. It was not something that was automatically approved. It was bitterly fought, debated, and approved on a split vote. But you know, a lot of people thought downtown would go down further because the downtown mall concept was adopted. And now it certainly is one of the most successful downtowns in the country. But it took a lot. It took time. It took vision and time.
Hi. This is a question for Ed. I think you... Can you hear me now?
I could hear you before, but go ahead.
I think you gave a terrific talk, and I have a page full of notes here. I was really excited, and I was with you all the way until the last sentence. And I don't remember exactly what the last sentence was, but the train of thought that it got going was how can you – I'm very interested in the whole population question. And can you have a sustainable, beautiful community if you just keep trying to accommodate everyone who wants to live here? And can I worry that, you know, people will love this community to death?
Well, it's a very good question, and I'm not sure I have the answer to it, but I will say this. We are a growing country. We are the only industrialized country that is gaining population. We're going to add 100 million people to the U.S. economy, to the U.S. nation, by the year 2050. 100 million people. You got to put them somewhere. And so it's not like they're not going to be here. It's not like they're going to go away. And so the question is, how do you use them to create better communities, not worse communities? I mean, I think population is a big issue, but I don't think it inevitably means you got to have it has to deteriorate your quality of life. But you know, there is a concept called carrying capacity. It means looking at, you know, what is the carrying capacity of a community in terms of population or, you know, stormwater or development or, you know, all kinds of things. It's a concept that a number of communities use, like Sanibel, Florida, is an example of that. They figured out, well, we could only have this many people who live on the island if we wanted to safely evacuate them in terms of hurricane. And if we built more than that, that would be exceeding the carry capacity of the island, and it means that all the wildlife from the Ding Darling National Wildlife Refuge would go away, et cetera. So, yes, there can be negative impacts, but the idea of all the folks up here is to try to figure out how to actually deal with those externalities and make things better, not worse.
I am in total agreement with everybody on the panel in terms of what our assets are, but where I came from, we also had the asset of inviting our neighbor. I was a president of my neighborhood watch, okay? So we don't have that in Charlottesville. In fact, when Belvedere was burning the trees down and throwing the grave sites and things like that to make their buildings, I was on the panel to try to get that stopped, and I tried to get all my neighbors involved. Well, guess what? They didn't know how. They didn't know how to go to the town council. They thought they were prohibited. I don't know what. But where I come from in Teaneck, New Jersey, which if you go there right now, you'll see a very quaint town because of the people. And I stood up in front of many people and was invited. Okay? And that's what we need here. I think it's population is not a problem. People who come from different places will tell you that a community evolves fine if everybody participates, but also the town council must invite this. Like, we must be, as presidents of to the neighborhoods,
two comments
be
on
invited.
That. One, none of us is as smart as all of us. And so you're absolutely right about community participation. The more participation you have, the better results you will get. Second, though, there's one place in America where almost no one listens to any place else. And you know where that place is? It's called a public hearing. And, you know, people come to public hearings with their minds made up and they talk past each other. So what you need is a forum for dialogue outside of public hearings. I think this is one of those examples. I mean, I think this is why you need a group like Charlottesville Tomorrow to provide a forum for dialogue that's not related to a specific entitlement or something else where everybody's going to go in and yell at each other and already had their minds made up. So we need more public participation, yes, but we also need some ways to do that outside of like a public hearing process.
Over on the other side, yeah.
Hello. Oh. Hi, thank you. My name's Kathy Galvin, and I've had the pleasure of working with Mr. Bates and Mr. Rooker in the past, hopefully with Dean Tanzer in the future. I'm an architect, and I'm also on the city school board. We've kind of touched upon this already, that the two things Americans hate the most are sprawl and density. So it does suggest that there is a little cognitive dissonance in the public. So could you speak, and this is to the whole panel, but probably first to Ed, what are some of the benefits that you see of density, how it can help you afford amenities?
Right.
And secondly, where have you seen a good balance of regulation of that density so it didn't compromise the quality of life in existing neighborhoods?
Right. Well, you don't have to go very far to see a good example. That's Arlington County, Virginia, which I think, in my judgment, is the best example in America of good transit-oriented development. And I tell you why. I think, you know, you're absolutely right about that. There's two things Americans don't like. They don't like sprawl and they don't like density. But, you know, how do you get, you know, density that people will accept? All right, so density demands design, demands good design. If you want more ugly look-alike buildings stuck closer together, then nobody's going to like them, right? You know, we have this program in Maryland called Smart Growth, right? Well, everybody just thought it meant more, you know, look-alike houses that were all tan, beige, putty, and taupe with a big two-car garage sticking out front, stuck closer together. Well, they didn't like that, right? So if you want denser communities, they got to be the best-looking communities. That's number one. Number two, and this is what Arlington demonstrates to us, if you say you're going to have density everywhere, then someone will get upset about that. What Arlington has done successfully is they have put a rope around density. For 30 years, they said all of our density will be in two places, along Wilson Boulevard, on top of the retro tracks, and on Columbia Pike, which is their other major commercial corridor. Nowhere else will you have high-rises and lots of density. Okay, Wilson Boulevard is one of the densest commercial corridors in the United States. It used to be a crapola, you know, commercial strip lined with Jiffy Lubes and used car lots. And now it is a happening urban place that all the young people who can't afford to live in D.C. want to live there. Okay, but two blocks away, you have some of the most beautiful single-family neighborhoods you have ever seen. Okay, and they will always be beautiful single-family neighborhoods because they said, this is where the density is going to be, and this is where it's not going to be, okay? I think those are the two key things you need to get people to accept density. Also, the third thing I want to say, I've written extensively on this, density does not always mean high-rises. There are lots of very dense neighborhoods in America that don't have high-rises. I work in one, Georgetown, okay? Georgetown is one of the most beautiful neighborhoods on the planet. You know what the net density of Georgetown is? It's 38 units an acre. Okay. How about Old Town Alexandria? Okay, 28 units an acre. All the houses in Old Town Alexandria cost $1 million and up.
Okay, why does somebody want to pay $1 million for a house that's 17 feet wide and it's 150 years old? Is it because they like to do home repair? No. It's because it's one of the most beautiful, walkable neighborhoods on the planet. People will pay a lot for walkability and charm, and density can come with that. I actually do have a great slideshow I use on just on the density question. I'll show you, you know, three high-rise condos in Las Vegas, okay? They're like 28 stories each or something, okay? And I say, how do you like that? Then I'll show people the French Quarter. And guess what? The French Quarter is higher density than those high-rise condos. The French Quarter is like 42 acres a unit, 42 units an acre. Everybody loves the French Quarter. How about the Battery in Charleston, okay? Well, that's like much higher density than most typical, like, you know, develops like Sun City. Which one do you like better? You know, Sun City or the Battery in Charleston? Well, it's all about good design. That's what I have to say about it.
I think we have time for one more question.
Thinking of those two things about Albemarle County as a place with incredible biodiversity, you know, we saw in this presentation how not all urban spaces are created equal. I'd also put forth that maybe not all rural spaces are created equal. How do we create quality rural spaces and quality green space? Thank you.
Well, I think, you know, once again, it all begins with a vision for the future. I mean, if you have a vision for, you know, I'm co-authoring a book, the update of a book called Rural by Design, along with Randall Arendt. It's all about, you know, what are the character, you got to, you know, what are the assets of a rural area that you want to preserve? And it's figuring, it's the same way with anything. What are those assets? How do you identify them? We spend, you know, way too much time talking about the tools as opposed to the ends. You know, I've spent a lot of time in Western North Carolina. There's not a single county in Western North Carolina except Buncombe County, which is Asheville, that has zoning of any kind, okay? So you talk, everybody, every time anybody in the community starts talking about zoning, everybody goes nuts and starts fighting. And, you know, like, get the guns, we're going to fight, talking about zoning. Well, but if you start asking what the ends are, what do you want the county to be like in the future? What do the county to look like in the future? Then people can start agreeing on those things, and then you figure out all the tools to get there. And that's what people need to do. Zoning is a tool. It's a means to an end. It's not an end in itself. There's lots of different ways to preserve rural areas. You know, how about a conservation easement? That's one. How about deed restrictions? That's one. You know, how about, you know, telling people about the value of nature so they'll want to save some more nature? That's another one. There's lots of different things you should do. It all begins with a vision for the future, in my judgment.
I want to thank everyone for coming tonight. We really appreciate the turnout and your support of Charlottesville Tomorrow. I want to thank the panelists for participating and for sharing their insights tonight. And, Ed, I believe you have a new book out. Do you want to plug that real quick?
It's called Conservation Communities Creating Value with Nature, Open Space, and Agriculture. It's available on Amazon.
And I know featured in the book is Bundoran Farm, a local conservation development on 29 South. So that may be of interest, uli.org. I believe is where you can get that book.
Yeah,
so, again, thank you very much. This will be podcast, so if you want to hear Ed's anecdotes again, minus the pictures, but at least you can hear his voice telling these stories, we'll make that available on our website. Thank you.
Thanks, Dan.
Good to see you.
That's my wife.
Over here. Okay.